Jordan. Good to see you again. Over to you.
Can you see me?
We can see you in all glorious technicolor.
Okay, the papers for this meeting consider comments on the recognition requirements in the draft, in the working draft, IFRS to replace IS 37. As is clear from the comment letters, the proposed recognition criteria are continuing to cause some concerns, particularly regarding how they would be applied to liabilities arising in legal proceedings. So what I've sought to do in these papers is come up with some ideas for addressing the difficulties. And if you make decisions on these matters today, my intention would be to consult informally on the decisions just to check that we're heading in the right direction before you make further decisions. If we start by turning to paper 8A, it concerns the proposal to remove the explicit, more likely than not, threshold from the judgment about whether a liability exists. We have recommended reversing this proposal, in other words, keeping the explicit threshold that's in IS 37 at present. And the reasons are summarised on the last page of paper 8A. I think that having a threshold is justified in this case because the judgment requires a prediction of future uncertain future events. And by keeping the threshold, it would help to avoid divergence in practice and address concerns that the proposed recognition criteria are more difficult to apply than the existing ones. So the question at the end of paper A is quite a simple one.
John, you're coming in and out.
The sound's coming and going, John, and if you want to have a word with Rudy, you're actually staying in the same position. I don't know what it is. Could you pull the microphone towards you? Oh, you can't. Out and hold it in your hand.
I can try and speak more directly into it.
That's okay.
Okay, that's better.
Okay. I was just saying the recommendation is that we keep the more likely than not threshold that we've got in IS 37 at the moment, and ask for your views on that recommendation.
Okay, the question's at the back of the paper. Going back to what we had before, anyone disagree with that? PK?
The question I want to ask is that perhaps this is not a question directly to John, but to all of us. What is the implication of changing this decision on other cross-cutting issues that we might have? And I just want to pause and think through what would be the implication of this decision, us changing the decision, the signal we are going to give in other projects. And I think having a threshold to recognize, and I made this point even last board meeting when Joan, when you were presenting, that I don't believe there should be a threshold for recognizing, but I do understand the concerns, but more than anything else, at this point in time, I want to pause and understand what are the cross-cutting issues, because in revenue recognition, for example, in the variable consideration, we have an issue about recognition based on expected values, and there are constituents who are asking for a threshold there also, and when we change this, are we immediately agreeing for that, and I want to understand that. Because it's going to give a signal immediately.
But isn't this an issue about non-contractual?
Yeah, and I was going to make the same points as John. That what we're dealing with here is uncertainty about whether the liability in that case exists or not. In the variable consideration question, there's no doubt that the contractual requirements exist. The doubt is about what the outcome is going to be.
PK, this has come up in a number of different jurisdictions when we've had discussions, and I see it really as a means of just providing some definition to what the board had previously decided, and I think as Joan said, we didn't actually focus sort of a great deal of attention, in a sense, removing the so-called threshold. I think what we have in the exposure draft is that you need to take into account all the relevant evidence relevant evidence. And in a sense, we were saying on the balance of probabilities, weight of evidence, whatever, do you have a liability or do you not? The existence question. And it seems to me what people have said to us is it's just all too subjective, all too vague. If you put back what was in there previously, we understand that it gives more definition to the making process. So that's all I see we're doing.
I appreciate the nuance between a contractual and non-contractual, but I think the aspect about this nuance may not be well appreciated, and I just want to say that if we are ready to do this, we are opening thought process in other places, and I don't think we will have enough ammunition to defend, if you want to defend the other decisions. All I'm trying to say is that, so I just want to be forewarned that there will be cross-cutting issues.
Okay, I've got Pat, Wegu, and Paul. Oh, sorry, Tatsu, you have two hands up.
Yeah, I do not understand. What kind of cross-cutting issue?
Like I said, the variable consideration.
Sorry?
Variable consideration, the aspect about whether it's contractual or non-contractual, is a point, but I don't know if people appreciate that. So like last 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, I was in Norwalk for revenue recognition, and there was a discussion. People very clearly said that they want to have a threshold for all binary requirements and variable consideration, and they want to have a more likely than not threshold before recognizing the variable consideration.
Well, that's...
Yeah?
That would be... To me, that once you have a contractual obligation, we're talking about measurement. And if you're not doing it that way, you could apply that logic to a lot of things. Derivatives, for example, and say, you know, it's out of the money. It's pretty unlikely it's going to happen. Don't measure it. I don't think we would do it that way.
I'm just saying that I'm just putting a marker down.
But my understanding is to focus on the existence, whether it is existed or not. So just it. It's different from the say the other criteria, which is the cash flow, cash out flow possibilities more likely than not. That is a totally different. It's a measurement issue, but this is a.
I agree. There is a difference between recognition and measurement. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that. Watch out for that.
But I don't think it's about recognition versus measurement per se. If you look at agenda paper 8 on page 3 with the flow chart. What we're dealing with at this stage is the first box.
Yes, I recommend that.
And the variable consideration is talking about the second box, which is what might be the outcome of that.
Okay, Pat?
I can accept the notion of going back to the criterion that we used to have. I think it helps to solve a problem. I just think that PK is touching on an issue that I have a concern with, and that is the way our framework is constructed today with respect to assets and liabilities. It's a three-pronged analysis. First is a test of existence. Second is a test of recognition. Third, measurement. It's challenging and problematic for preparers and legal counsel to determine whether or not a legal liability exists, and they want to build in some type of threshold, because a non-zero probability is just a very challenging assessment to make. But by, I guess, incorporating a threshold into the standard, we are somewhat in conflict with the framework. And I think the board should acknowledge that. Now, we have a standard currently that already exists, so it's in conflict, if you will. So we're going back to that approach. And I can live with that because it solves a practical issue. But I think it's something that we should all, you know, decide with eyes wide open. Maybe it's unique to legal liabilities, trying to determine whether something exists and then saying, well, give me a threshold as to whether or not, you know, it exists. Is it a 1% or is it a 50% existence? Because with that threshold, then you start to get into the question of do you recognize? Whereas that, you know, a 1%, many people might say, okay, a liability exists, but you wouldn't recognize it. So that's my only caveat here. And, you know, we have this issue, frankly, in the emissions trading project. We're going to deal with it in rate regulation and other areas. And I think you're right. It's appropriate to make a distinction between contractual liabilities and non-contractual. Maybe that's the point at which we make a distinction here with the framework.
And also, there is a lot of debate whether lawsuits are contractual or non-contractual. I don't think it's that easy to say. If somebody trips on my floor when I clean it up, whether it's contractual or non-contractual, is very difficult to tell. So I don't think the distinction is that clear, if it's contractual or non-contractual. Our liabilities come out of because of contractual obligation at the end of the day.
I don't really see why you said there was a conflict with the framework. I mean, if you're certain the liability doesn't exist, then there's nothing to recognise. If you're certain it does exist, there's something to recognise. We're dealing with a case where we're just not sure whether the liability exists or not at this point in the decision tree, and the framework doesn't really give us much help with that.
Well, that's exactly the problem, Peter. What we're building in to the definition of the first criterion of existence is a threshold. Our framework doesn't have that. Our framework today is a non-zero probability threshold. Here we're building in a more likely than not threshold. That's different from the framework.
Yeah, but if I can just come in there, the framework focuses on whether you have a liability. So it has existence, and then, as you said, it has recognition, and then it has measurement. IS 37 was then trying to provide, if you like, a greater focus on those various stages, if you like, in the measurement ultimate measurement of a liability than you get in the framework. So in 37, it has the existence question, which is whether it's more likely than not that you have a liability.
But that's different from the framework.
But as I said before, I think it's providing more definition and more guidance to actually how you make that decision as to whether there is a present obligation at this point in time.
You can frame it that way. I agree with you.
The framework then goes on and says, you know, you've then got a recognition step. And so does 37. That's where we have a lot of the debate. I don't think this, frankly, is particularly controversial. I think the next step is the more controversial.
Yes.
Which is the recognition.
Yeah. Okay. Let's bring others in.
All right.
Wade Wu and Paul.
The discussion now we just had among the board members recall me the fundamental questions are always not so clear. Is that, you know, whether this project is cover the broad recognition measurement principles for wide range of liabilities or a narrow scope of liabilities. That is traditional 37 type of liabilities. And in this series of papers, staff use a lot of examples, mainly legal related. I'm not sure, you know, maybe staff can tell me whether we still try to find out a general recognition and measurement principles for various kinds of liabilities. Originally, we decide maybe the scope is non-financial liabilities, or the staff has bring us back to a narrow scope liability that is maybe traditional 37 liabilities, contingent related. And this is my first question. Second question is whether in staff's minds we may have different recognition measurement principles for this type of liabilities from others.
Do you want to comment, John?
Well, regarding recognition, I think these are very unique. Well, they are unique liabilities in that they are unlike all others because you just don't know whether they exist or not. And that's why there's a need for these particular provisions in this standard when they're not necessary in any other standards.
So your answer is, you know, the criteria we're now discussing is narrow scoped.
I see them as being specific to this standard.
Paul?
I support the staff proposal. I think putting in more likely than not is consistent with the framework, with the definition of a liability in terms of probable outflow of resources. And I support it because we've been told that in this narrow group of liabilities, without this, our definition was not really workable in terms of accruing whether or not to recognize an obligation for these uncertain events. So both for consistency with the framework and, I think, practicability, I support the staff recommendation.
So,
I agree with what Paul said. In addition, the issue of narrow scope, I don't think this is a scope issue at all. I think you know you have a liability when it's contractual. When it's not contractual and there's some indications around, do I have an obligation? That's where this comes into play. So it's not like we've cut a line and said this is in, that's out. In one case, it's pretty obvious. This is dealing with the situation where it's not obvious right up front and then the guidance to do it.
But John, your cut between contractual and non-contractual is very difficult in practice. In saying that this is, what is non-contractual? If there's a lawsuit, if coffee spills, I go to McDonald's, and coffee is so hotter than what is required, and it spills on my thigh, and my skin gets burned, is it contractual or non-contractual? You can pass any number of times, any number of arguments. It's very difficult. I agree in revenue recognition, you can say, hey, there is a business combination or a revenue recognition, we have that, but it's very difficult, at least in practice, and I have defended this issue several times with PCOB, and every time it's very difficult to say contractual.
And so when you don't know, you follow this guidance. That's the whole purpose of it.
Okay. We've probably debated it long enough now. Could I see those who would agree with the staff recommendation? Two, three. That's 14, John. PK didn't go for it. Okay, 8B.
Right, on paper 8B, it became very clear once we posted the working draft IFRS up on the website that there was insufficient guidance in it as to how to apply the judgment about whether a liability exists. And we responded almost straight away by adding a staff paper onto the website. And the comments that we received back on that was, well, first of all, that the respondents would like more guidance in the IFRS itself. Broadly, they supported the direction of the guidance in the staff paper, but with some caveats to that. And so, taking into account all of their suggestions, I've drafted some guidance which is in the appendix to paper 8B. And the purpose today is to seek your feedback on the guidance. It's a very early draft, so it's your sort of preliminary comments with a view to establishing whether you think that we could go out and seek wider views on the guidance from our constituents. The questions are on the final page of paper 8B, page 12, and I've identified two particular matters for discussion and then asked for just general comments on the rest of the draft guidance. The first question is on the broad criteria by which a preparer would judge whether a liability exists. And I've identified two tests. The first one, which has a typo in it, is if the case proceeds to court, the courts will rule against the entity. And the second test would be that the entity, it's more likely than not that the entity will offer an out-of-court settlement instead of defending the case. So you would identify liability if either of these two conditions were met. And the first question is whether you agree whether these are good, appropriate criteria for identifying liabilities in legal proceedings.
Okay, just before Paul comes in, as far as the appendix is concerned, we won't get into drafting. Any sort of general point, fine, and if you've got any detail, pass it on to Joan afterwards. Okay, Paul, and then Jan.
Joan, I just I want to ask a question on both of your examples, which I think are good. How are they affected by what our immediately preceding decision on more likely than not? I was happy to hear you say orally just now, for example, be more likely than not, or the one on early stages of lawsuits. And in fact, your appendix uses that phrase, but you don't up front. And in question one, you say the court will rule against the entity. Should that now be, it's more likely than not that the court will rule against the entity? And in case of early stage of a lawsuit, again, doesn't more like, isn't our new criterion now more likely than not?
Yes, it is. And I didn't put the more likely than not in paper 8B in case you didn't pick that up. But in the appendix, in the drafting itself, paragraph C22 shows the wording as it would be with the more likely than not. And yes, it would become, if the case proceeds to court, it's more likely than not that the courts will rule against the entity, or it is more likely than not that the entity will offer an out-of-court settlement.
Good, and then I support the staff recommendation.
Okay, we probably should concentrate on C22 rather than just look at the question there. Okay, Jan, you were next.
Yeah, well, I just feel that for me it's a little bit premature to discuss this detail, and I think that might be an important part, but I think it would be better if you went out and discussed this with those who have complained and see that you get a lot of buy-in to your proposal. And then we discuss it, instead of us now trying to come up with a solution that people will reject. So if you have more of the outreach you are expecting to have, without us having expressed too much of an opinion, I think that would be easier for me. I also think when I read this that it's very focused on the legal part. It's just a piece of this document that we will present in the future. So for me, it's much too early to discuss this topic.
John, just picking up Jan's point, you have already gone out on this, haven't you? Perhaps you could explain what you have done already, and this is specifically to deal with the legal issue, you're just as far as this particular business is concerned, because that was one of the major criticisms we got, is that right?
Yeah, I haven't gone out with this wording yet, because what I've done is that I've talked to people about the lack of guidance and used the suggestions to draft something, and my intention will be to maybe stick it up on the website and ask people and go out and talk to anybody who's interested, really, to get their views on whether it's heading in the right direction, which is why I said today, you know, I'm not seeking detailed approval or final approval of this at all. It's really just, is this roughly something that you think we should go out and consult on further?
Warren, then.
Yeah, I just want to Jan's point, though, Joan. I think what you've tried to do here is responsive to concerns that you've heard and feedback that we've received in terms of comment letters and roundtable
and all the outreach that we were doing during the comment period. It was consistently coming up with the same points, And of course, we had the staff paper, so it's trying to update the staff paper into something that could fit into an IFRS.
Okay, thank you. Tatsumi?
So, I have trouble with C22B. That is, say, your position is the entity will offer an out-of-court settlement instead of defending the case. So, that means that just that there is an existence of my will to settle out of court. So based on my intention, we will judge whether there is an existence of the liability or not. That troubles me a lot. I understand when I read the examples, say, the patent infringement, it takes a lot of time to get through the lawsuit. So then management might think it's better to settle out of the court. I understand that logic, but say, to based on my own will, I could change my own will. So what say, based on my changeable will, I could say there is the existence of the liabilities. That logic, I have a lot of trouble. So it seems to me your logic is not in line with definition of liability in the contractual framework. What do you think about that?
John, I thought I read in the papers that this would be based on experience as well. It's not just the you know, one-off. This is what normally happens too, and you just settle it rather than fight your way through it.
I think I've really put the explanation in paragraphs 25 to 31, and I understand Tatsumi's concern here. What I was trying to address was this practical problem that we have with many types of litigation is that they never reach court. And in particular, the patent infringement type case that I identified there. And so it's not so much based on management intention as to whether how they're going to progress the court the case. It's more like that they've got to the stage where they've acknowledged that the possibility of a liability existing is so high that this is the route that they will be taking to get out of it. It is more of a practical shortcut to identifying a liability than an attempt to say, well, it all depends on what your intention is. And it's, I thought, a practical solution in this otherwise extremely tricky situation where identifying liabilities is unusually difficult.
Yeah, John, so in that case, you should link face this C22B in a limited situations. It seems to me that the example in here is convincing, it seems to me, but but still, the wording in C22B, it seems to me very wide open to many cases. So I rather C22B should be limited in some cases.
Well, if you look at 28, when it says most cases in the US, almost all of them are dealt with by settlement, they don't come to court. I think that's what Jordan's trying to catch.
Yeah, but I'm not quite sure. In my jurisdiction, it's not.
Well, you'd be an A then, not a B. But, John, you wanted to come in. There's a whole lot here. I've got John, Pat, Warren, and Philippe. And you, Elka, too.
I kind of agree with Tatsumi. I was a little concerned. We're not. I agree with A. I think that's a good way to think about that. But on the B piece, what was troubling me was we're not requiring anyone to accrue for the defending the lawsuit. And it seems to me in B, I'm either going to defend or settle. And I usually would settle if it's going to cost me more to defend. But yet if I decide that I'm going to defend, I do nothing. And so it seems that do I really have a liability here until I make the decision that I'm going to settle? And perhaps if there's a way to tighten it up, there's a past practice of doing this, and that might be a way to do it. But just the way I read it in terms of more likely than not, I'll do it. I can decide, free choice.
Okay. I could perhaps do something like it's restrict it to cases where experience suggests that the case will not reach court, but will be settled beforehand. Then you would use this criterion. So you would need some evidence that the case isn't actually ever going to reach court.
Pat?
Well, I was delighted to see this in John's paper. Because in my experience, it is the situations where lawsuits are settled that has really troubled the user community, particularly in the United States. It's one of the reasons why they've always thought the FASB standard in this area was broken, because there'd be huge legal suits, and there's been a number of very high-profile ones during the recent years. And the financial statements, the notes, would just continue to say management was unable to estimate. And there's, you know, a number of situations where 2 days after the Q was released where it said management was unable to estimate, they settled for an enormous sum of money. Well, they must have been thinking about it if it was only a few days later. So I was absolutely delighted to see this in Jones' paper. I think it's absolutely what we need.
Did you feel Peaky let you down with the auditing? Was that the problem?
Yeah. Yeah.
Could I ask you? So I'm same situation. The day before the queue, I'm going to defend this. Queue goes out. Gee, here's a number I hadn't thought of. I think we're going to.
What's the queue?
What's the queue?
That's the quarter mark.
Could you speak in English?
The queue.
Yeah. I think in your opinion type of English.
That's an anachronism.
Something to solve your problem, that's all.
I think those situations would be very, very rare, John, where information came up the day after the quarterly report that made you settle 2 days later.
But that's what you're complaining about.
No, what I'm complaining about is that clearly management must have been thinking about settling to come up with an estimate to make an offer and to have the offer accepted. And so there was clearly evidence, and if it was more likely than not at that date that they were going to settle, then they should have.
So if I settle 2 days after I disclose my quarterly information, and I contend that that's when I decided. Before that, it was up in the air, wasn't sure. You're going to say, because it was within 3 days, I was over. That's just going to cause some problems.
Well, I assume that the auditors are there. We're really looking at
forget
things.
That.
Yeah.
For
care
don't
care
count on it. Don't count on it. Okay, Warren?
I'm happy to go with this, Joan. I think you've done a good job with those papers responding to the concerns that have been expressed. And like a number of other board members, you know, I did have a little bit of an issue with this because on the face of it, it appears to be, as I think the chairman said, directly in conflict with other parts of the document, particularly where it says that something isn't a liability if it's within the control of the entity. And so, as John was saying, well, sort of it is in your control whether you settle or not. But I think what you've got to make clear in the drafting, which you will, I know, is that we're talking about existence, and you've said in the paper accompanying the appendix here that this is seen as a practical expedient in a way, that in these sorts of circumstances, we think you should take this into account as evidence of whether existence, whether a liability exists or not. So I think you just need to be make sure that we're open about what the nature of this is, so that it's not so blatant that this is inconsistent with other parts of the document. The second point is this is focusing really on the troublesome litigation liabilities. I think we need to be careful in the drafting and the standard itself that we don't forget that there are other troublesome liabilities that are covered by 37, and one of those is constructive obligations, where you've got an existence question as well and the question of evidence. So just need to make sure in the drafting that this isn't just pointing towards one of those troublesome issues.
Okay. Philippe?
Yes, on the questions raised by Tatsumi and others on the Appendix AB and the wording of C22, I don't read that as being on a free choice situation. To me, it's more either-or situation. If I don't propose a settlement, the matter will proceed to court, I will lose. I have a liability. But I have a possibility, and this is where my management choice comes into play, I have a possibility to take the matter out of court and to settle. Then it may be optimal for me to do it and to lessen my liability. I still have a liability. So in both cases, you have a liability. The question is, what is the management attitude in preserving the interest of the entity, which may be to take it out of court and to settle. But I don't think you would come out in 622 in any instance where you would not recognize a liability. It's just the contour of a liability that may change depending on whether you are in 622A or B. So maybe the wording can be improved a little bit to make it clearer. But to me, there was no case where I would not have a liability once I have decided that it's more likely than not that I have a situation I will lose if it goes to court.
All right. Well, I thought if you concluded it's more likely than not you would lose, you have a liability.
Yes.
B is dealing with a situation where you haven't concluded it's more likely than not you have a liability, but it's more likely than not that you're going to settle just because it would cost you more to defend this thing.
Okay, so that could be a situation which would be in between the two. Then I don't like that. I think...
You're on my side.
Could be on your side if you could read that as being, yes, I don't know about the legal case. I know that I may settle, but I don't know whether I will, so I don't know at all where I am in this case, not at all.
That's what I think Steph's saying here.
In that case, I'm avoiding a legal case with the settlement, and therefore...
Yeah, why would I... Well, okay, then maybe that needs to be dealt with. I mean, did not come to my mind that maybe this third case. To me, it was either A or B, as it is drafted. But maybe there is something which I miss here.
I think John helped. John came in too about the practical experience and past evidence and so on. This is what happens. Okay, PK?
You know,
more likely than not, it's off the table, of course.
I'm not talking about that. I'm not like Tatsumi to come back on the same issue.
No, no, of course not.
What does it mean?
Yes.
Now, one question I want to ask John, and maybe when I read Para 30, being an auditor not too long ago, this is an area of extreme nervousness. The question I want to ask, and maybe this is implied, but I want to be very clear. This is only those situations where the case does not reach the court. What happens more often than not, there are situations where the parties decide mid-course, you know, let me settle this. Does this, your guidance, cover that? Or is it only for situations where it does not? I just want to be very clear.
So, do you mean it's been through one court, but still has others?
No, it's any court. No, it's in the first court, and I am bent on fighting with John Smith. But halfway I said, you know what, he's an old guy, let me just settle with him.
Good idea.
So, what do I do with that? Is it part of your guidance? Because when I read Para 30, I don't know whether I got there completely.
No, I think reading it, it looks like it's only before it's got to court, but I would have thought exactly the same would apply if you had already got to court, and I probably need to tweak the wording.
Yes. The second point I want to ask is that, is there any, this is a really complex area, is there any thought in the C-23 you mentioned about legal precedent set in similar cases, and that's a good guidance. I might offer something to settle, but there's no chance the other party will accept it because John Smith, in this my example, is bent on taking me down all the way. So what happens? Where is the likelihood of the other party accepting it? Because I might offer $10 to settle John and go away, but John wants $1 million.
So
I'm moving the ball towards some recognition, but not all the way. So I just want to understand where is the other party's intention.
So what you mean is it's not whether you will offer an out of court settlement; it's whether it will result in an out of court settlement.
Yes.
Good point. Thank you.
But also, we're not doing the measurement just now. The fact that you've switched. You're acknowledging there's going to be a liability. You're really just after existence at the moment, Joe, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Not measurement.
Yes.
No. So you only meet phase one. It's a liability. Now the next question is a $10. Stupid, you know.
Stupid.
Yeah. You get some coffee, you'll be fine. Okay. We've got various. Oh, sorry, Amaro.
Thank you. I think that the discussion on the ways confirms Jan's initial perception that also very appreciated the Johan test the wording with the interested parties. And I think at the end it was mentioned, I think what is missing in paragraph C22 is the real part of this past experience. Companies generally have a historical approach to settle in advance most of the discussions in the specific cases that they have a history. So I would suggest adding something in between or in the wording paragraph in item B that stress the historical experience in settling cases, similar cases. And this is what is missing in my reading here. So past experience would drive before the perception that you offer an out-of-court settlement.
It is there in the introductory paragraph because it starts by saying if the available evidence indicates that the entity will offer an out-of-court settlement. So that was what I was meant meaning in the first place, but I think there will be scope for stressing that.
Yeah, and that was John's point too, I think, Joan.
Yeah.
Okay, can we look at the question now? With the improvements that have been suggested that Joan has accepted, can I put the first question? Who would agree with the Joan recommendation? Okay, that's 13. Who else? Jan and Tatsumi were doubtful.
Okay.
Question two.
Question two. The other point I've specifically picked up asking you to approve is guidance that we've included in relation to the very early stages of litigation. A few respondents suggested that until you've got to a certain stage of litigation and have a certain degree of confidence in the outcome and having a certain amount of evidence one way or another, the default position should be that you wouldn't recognise a liability because you have insufficient evidence to support it. And in paragraphs 35 and 36 of paper 8B, I've put forward another view, which is that at any stage in the litigation, you've got some evidence. It may be more or less specific, and hence at any stage of the litigation, you should balance the available evidence and reach a judgment based on what is available rather than how much confidence you've got in the result. And I just wanted to check whether you agreed with taking that position in the draft guidance.
Okay, this is just a case of stepping over the threshold. So you keep going. The minute you come over the threshold, it's like more likely than not, bang, you're in. So it doesn't matter when it is. You don't have to wait to the very end. That's all Joan's saying, that right? Anyone disagree? Jan?
Well, I have an opinion. The opinion is I don't disagree, but I question if we really need a guidance on this. And I think it's you're in situations where you can start questioning if you have the process, if it's moving forward, and I would also say partially related to the third paper we have here, how this move forward. So I really question we need the guidance, and I question if we're coming with a question in the right order now before we haven't, because I don't like your proposal on paper three, the C paper. So that impacts me.
Okay, Jan's made a put down a marker for three. C, Paul?
Yep.
Joan, I have a small question on C24, which is your example on early stages.
Yes.
In C22, for example, the issue is existence of a liability, not recognition or measurement. But in C24, you have added the clause and can be measured reliably. Are you in C-24, are you then skipping over existence? Are you now at recognition by putting that clause in? Do you need that clause there?
What I was intending to do was saying that early on you might reach one judgment, and later on you might reach another judgment as the evidence changes. And what I wanted to say was you recognise a liability when you get to the stage, if the available evidence suggests that you have an obligation. I only added the reference to measurement because that is another criteria for recognition. I think I might be better changing the words here and saying that instead, rather than talking about recognition, I go back to just talking about identification. So rather than saying the entity recognises a liability, maybe I could say the entity identifies a liability when management first judges that it is more likely than not that a liability exists.
Yeah, I think that would be consistent with 22 then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other points?
I think I've not got any serious problem with the criteria in here, but I'm questioning myself why we need all that detailed guidance on litigation issues. Is it just because we moved away from more likely than not, and now we have digged our hole and we are falling into our hole? Because I'm getting a bit nervous that we put in a lot of very detailed guidance, which is always then asking for the next sentence to be to clarify the sentence we've put in beforehand. And as I'm not too familiar with the old, old history of this, I'm really asking myself, do we need this all put in, or are we getting overly descriptive because we got these questions when we changed from more likely than not to our new concept, and if we leave it as is, this goes away?
John, what do you say to that? Are we having to give variations because of what we've now reversed in 3E?
It's a good question, and I think that some of the questions arose because we'd taken away the threshold, but I still think that there was also the question of how would we judge if a liability exists or not? What is the test? And we've got quite a simple test, which should reassure people that it's not much different from what they're doing at the moment, because the test is based on the outcome. And one of the concerns that people have is that by removing the probable outflows criterion, we're taking the focus off outcome and putting it onto existence without saying what we mean by existence. I think, you know, it's a good question, and it's certainly something we can think about. And consult.
I think you're just confirming my sense that we've digged the hole we fell in. Now we put a lot of guidance around instead of saying, couldn't we please avoid the hole by sticking to the definition we had beforehand and not to get overly descriptive on something again. But I'm just concerned that we are describing a lot of things which I think are common sense and I would full-heartedly agree to, but you're creating more questions than you're solving, providing answers.
Can I make a comment? I understand what you're saying, Elke, but I think, Joan, what we've found is that as the US has taken more interest, if you like, in this project, focused more on it, perhaps with the prospect of having to deal with it at some point in the future, it's become evident to us that we need to provide more guidance that's either in 37 or was in the exposure draft in terms of this question of existence. And that, as you said, Joan, this becomes much more problematic when you don't have the recognition threshold. So I think it's responding to concerns that constituents have expressed.
But also to pick up on Elka's points, I mean, we know that people have expressed concerns in the US about the existing 37 before any changes we make to it. So I think that's also trying to respond to some of those concerns.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. Well, we'll have to watch that when the final drafting comes. Anyone disagree with the recommendation? Okay. John? Okay. comments on the appendix? If someone's got a major comment, do we have that? If it's what about some of the words? So just give that to Joan. Is that okay? Anyone has a major comment? Wiggle? It's got to be major.
Yes. I'm not sure why, John, you delete all of the items in the paragraph 14. The appendix.
And move to Stephen.
The intention wasn't to delete them. It's more that I think I've moved them into the application guidance behind and covered them, and in some cases in more detail later on. So it's more that they've been moved than that they've been deleted.
Okay,
I'm going to make a very quick comment here. Warren. Sorry. Joan, Wagwo's question relates part to what I said before about constructive obligations. You need to have a look at whether there isn't something there that would apply more broadly.
Okay.
Rather than just in the context of litigation.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, question four, we've pretty well agreed that's going to happen, Joan, that you are going to go out anyway, Jan's point earlier. You don't want them to go out way more?
No, the staff proposed maybe put out into our web some kind of staff draft. I'm not sure whether this is a good idea because we have our agenda papers which are already open to the public, and we will have an update. Summarize the decision board made today, and I'm not sure this is a good idea to have another some kind of draft on the web. I'm not sure whether it's a good idea.
The problem that I think we've had in the past is that all the decisions that we've made on recognition in the past have all been in board papers. They've all been reported in update, and yet when we came to publish the draft IFRS, the working draft IFRS, somehow many, many people hadn't picked them up.
It's hard for people.
Okay, so the idea, Joan, is you're going to write it up in draft form, take some consultations about that, but we won't be bringing this one back until after June, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Can we turn to HC?
Can I just find one other point in this paper, really, for other projects, which is in paragraphs 13 to 15, discussion about whether you have to look at all evidence or reasonably available evidence. I think that's an issue that comes up on quite a few projects, and we probably ought to try to be consistent when we try and deal with that.
I think this was actually the most important point for me in this paper, and I understood that we somehow skipped it because we are mostly focusing on the suggestions, draft, and outreach about the institution. I would expect the same concept that we have in RevReg to be applicable here. I don't see any major difference. I don't know why. And John used a word that worried me a little bit. That in somehow in paragraph they say that it's not necessary to limit the access to information. I don't think we are limiting the use of information. In 2015, there is no need to limit the evidence to each entity. In paper 8B paragraph, there is no need to limit the evidence to each entity. I don't think using the concept we are limiting. And I think it would be appropriate to have the same wording.
Joan, are you going ahead with all available or all reasonably available?
All available, but I could add into the consultation all reasonably available and just sort of and ask for views on that when I'm talking to people.
Yeah, but my point really is that this is coming up in comment lists on other projects as well, and we just want to look at it in a reasonably consistent way.
Okay, we move to HC.
Right, paper 8C. Back in 2005, you proposed to remove the probable outflows recognition criterion from IS 37. The proposal wasn't re-exposed this time around, but a lot of people have commented on it, showing that it still remains a sensitive and contentious issue for a lot of people. So in this paper, I've set out the reasons for removing the probable outflows criterion, the comments we received, and my possible responses to some of these comments. And the conclusions are on the second last page, page 12, in which I conclude that this remains an issue that is causing sufficient concern that we need to keep engaging with people on it. I think some of the opposition arises from misunderstandings about the implications. Some arises because we haven't done enough so far to explain why the board hasn't reversed this proposal, despite opposition. But I do still think that there are good reasons for removing the probable outflows criterion. So the recommendations on the last page is that you tentatively reaffirm the previous proposal to remove the probable outflows criterion, but that I engage with people to explain the reasons and seek feedback at an early stage so that we can come back to this if necessary.
Okay. This is one that Joan's proposing to explore further. You may have to bring it back if you eventually decide to do that. But in the meantime, going out, testing it without it, and seeing if the drafting does help with that. If not, you've got a decision to make.
So why do we need to reaffirm it if we are to...
Well, it's only just to say, do you think we or are you totally opposed to keeping it out in the first place? I think that's all.
I'm totally opposed.
All right.
We know you. Okay. I'm totally in support. Stronger than you are.
The question, having gone back to more likely than not, and therefore you established that as a threshold for recognition.
Existence.
Is this still the same thing? Is this still an issue?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah.
It is an issue.
It is.
Okay, Elke?
I would support that we need more outreach, but basically I'm in line with Jan. I get the feeling that the outflow is a needed criteria, and I'm not really convinced why we want to remove it. So I would pose it as an open question with an outreach to say, is the threshold sufficient to get us across the line, or is it back to square one?
Comment?
Well, I'm the same line. It's in the outreach process, I think taking this together with the decision that we just made in paper B would be the key message that we need for our final decision on this. What I'm hearing generally is that the IS-37, this aspect is not broken. Let's say it's consistent and applied in this aspect. So I don't know if returning to the or with the new wording as approved as discussed in 8B, we'll have problem with this concept or not.
Yeah, I think Joan's paper demonstrates that it is broken, in the sense that we've moved on in our deliberations. We moved on in IFRS 3 when we looked at contingencies, and we had to make an exception to 37. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a consistent accounting within the context of the principle in IFRS 3, which was fair value. I think it's inconsistent with what we're doing in the insurance project, which doesn't have a threshold. If you've got existence by virtue of a contract and then you're into measurement, there's no, is it more likely than not that I will make a payment to policyholders? We got ourselves in all sorts of trouble when we were trying to deal with IFRS 4 and IS 39 in the context of guarantees. And you get the nonsensical outcome now that if you're accounting for it as an insurance, if you're accounting for it as a guarantee under IS 39, you end up potentially accounting for it at the higher of the value you'd get under IS 18 or IS 37. But IS 37 only kicks in
if it's more likely than not that you'll make a payment under the guarantee. If you're not in that part of 39, you're in another part, and it's a derivative, similar sort of instrument, then you're accounting for it at fair value and you don't have a more likely than not threshold. So it's just a mess. So I think IAS 37 is broken, and we've demonstrated that. It needs to be fixed. Satsumi.
Thank you. John, I think I support this proposal, obviously, but I often hear in my jurisdiction that just removal of this probability criterion will lead to the, say, enormous cost or effort for them to check every possibilities, because under current 37, if the possibility of the cash out flow is less than 50%, it's not necessary for them to look at, even if they don't care about that. But by removing this, when it comes to the, say, measurement, they have to just pay attention to the such a remote cases. So that means, say, you keep telling them that this change will not affect your calculation, but from their point of view, they have to take care of some remote cases, cash out for possibilities less than 50%, just to pay attention that is a sort of the cost for them. So you should find out how to overcome that kind of assertion.
Thank you, Tatsumi. What I can try and probe that when I'm talking to people, because I find that a lot of people talk about the theoretical problems that you will have more liabilities to recognize, but not so many can come forward with examples that they themselves would have to start recognizing, or if they do, it's not huge numbers of them. So I will try and probe that when I'm talking to people.
Okay, can I suggest that, with your permission, we accept the conditions but set it out under the new criteria, because we've gone back, this is under 1,000, we've gone back to another one. Joan better go and test it, and the fallback is quite clearly to revert back to what we had before. But that's going to be a decision you'll have to make when the feedback comes back. Would anyone disagree with that? So we test it under the new thing to see if it holds up and is better. If not, you have to revert.
Okay.
Is that okay, John?
Yes.
Yes, well, it's not going to be our decision. It's going to be a decision after June that if this doesn't work, we can't convince people it helps, then presumably you have to go back to what you had before or something else.
I'd say...
Assuming you won't be here to make the decision.
Okay. Thank you for...
I'm not sure it's a question of whether it works. It can work because we're doing it in insurance and so on. It's a question of whether the board wants to be consistent.
Okay.
Okay, can we go ahead on that basis?
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Joan.
Was there any vote on that in terms of the probability criterion, or is it just
I'll take a vote now then if you want one. Who would rather not go ahead with testing it without the probability criterion? To Elke and Jan, the rest in favour, going ahead.
Testing.
But you voted against the testing.
No, I voted for testing, but being it an open question.
Rather
than saying we have defined, we want to go for the new one.
No, we haven't done that.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, Joan, we go ahead on the basis you recommend, and we look forward to getting the results in due course. Could you tell us, Joan, what you intend to do now?
First of all, pulling the sort of conclusions and decisions from this paper with the draft guidance into some sort of staff paper, which I could then make available to people who are interested to discuss it with them. And the rest will depend on priorities for this project and other projects as to what else I'll be doing from now on.
Right, okay, Joan, thanks. Okay, so written up do some outreach, get some views, and then if there's time, it could come back. If not, it would be up to you.
David, do we need formally to withdraw the existing method? We have currently out on PD, we have a staff draft. What is the status of the old PEP?
There's going to be a new staff draft.
Okay, so it's clear that this is replacing, and the rest is withdrawn in a way.
What was the way? The latest draft counts.
Okay.
Okay. Is that okay, Joan?
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, can we move on to the next issue, which is Michael's Haven 9?
Yes. And we're also joined by Lucy with respect to this issue. And this is the look at the comment letters that we received on the exposure draft for the removal of fixed dates from IFRS 1. So take you through that and ask you a couple of questions relating to the finalisation of that.